Good morning, everyone. If I could have your attention. Thank you very much for coming to this in our latest of knowledge transfer event. Firstly, I'd like to apologise. Paul Wilson is unable to be here this morning, so I'm standing in to introduce today's speaker, and that's Dr. Dov Steckel from MISIB, the Multidisciplinary Centre for Integrative Biology. Dov is also, I suppose, part of my division, Agricultural and Environmental Science. And just before I hand over to Dov, to say a little bit about his background, I do recommend you have a look at his laboratory, his research laboratory online. Some very interesting information there about the sort of thing that Dov's been doing and some of the things he's been doing before he came to Nottingham. So I'll just say that he did, and correct me if I get anything wrong here, Dov, maths at Cambridge for his first degree, then applied his mathematical skills to a PhD in the zoology department at Cambridge. And then he worked for a number of companies in broadly bioinformatics, and also found time to write a book on bioinformatics as well. He then went to Birmingham University as a lecturer, and then joined us, I think it was 2009, here at Nottingham. So Dov's going to talk to us about mathematical modelling, what's it all about, so I'll hand over to Dov.
Well, thank you very much, Steve, for the introduction, and thank you, everyone, for coming, and for the organisers to invite me. This is a somewhat daunting task, I think, because I expect that at least some of you may be rather terrified of maths. Certainly, many of the undergraduates I teach are, and also maybe people may be questioning, well, what's maths got to do with biology anyway? And what I hope to do is to give a very brief tour of some of the history and a few achievements in mathematical biology over many thousands of years, as you will see, and but obviously focusing on the more recent period. I will be talking also about the use of computers, because that's an important part of what goes on in any kind of mathematical biology enterprise, and we'll be linking maths and biology to the history of computing generally as well. And I will talk very briefly about some of the projects that are currently going on in my lab. These are the projects that are funded with experimental collaborators here in Sutton Bonington. Well, I'll start with numbers, because really, mathematics and biology have gone hand in hand since the dawn of civilization. Indeed, they predate the invention of writing, and it's probably fair to say it's what led to the invention of writing. On the top left side of the screen, we have some Sumerian counters. Some of these are over 10,000 years old, and these were used for counting primarily agricultural produce. The one that I can read is the one with a little plus in the top right of that group of seven, and that means one sheep. And if you wanted to count sheep, you would collect a number of these counters and you'd know how many sheep you had. Now, by about 5,000 years ago, the use of counters had been superseded by the use of clay tablets. And again, you can see here a clay tablet from Uruk in ancient Sumer, in Mesopotamia, and it is about 5,000 years old. And if you look at the middle panel, the panel with a little plus and five notches, for those who are familiar with reading proto-cuneiform, you will of course know that that says five sheep. And for those who are less familiar with proto-cuneiform writing, the little plus, like the counter, means sheep. And then the five notches mean five. I mean, there are five of them, basically. And this, indeed, is the origin of counting in writing, and indeed the origin of writing itself. Of course, what's interesting, of course, is the first things that people wanted to write down were counting agricultural produce, or biological entities. Now, one might argue that the reasons for this were economic, and that's quite possibly likely to be the case. But then, of course, some of the research that we do here in Sutton Bonington, indeed including research that Steve does, Steve who introduced me, is indeed farm economics. So Steve has antecedents from 10,000-year-old Mesopotamia, who are also doing farm economics, and indeed who invented the use of counting and writing in order to do so. It's also likely, though, that some of the use of counting of these biological entities would have been used as ways of trying to improve the agricultural produce, perhaps having more sheep or better crops or so forth in whatever ways people had available to them at their time. Now, some of that may have been in ways that we might regard as scientific today, but probably most of it wouldn't have been and might have been associated with things that we would regard as magic or religion or ways of appeasing the gods or helping the gods to help them to produce better produce. We might argue that's not scientific, but I would say that perhaps one would say that it's still driven by the same motivations, that is to try to manipulate the forces that govern the universe in ways to for our own advantage, which again is much of what we attempt to do here. Of course, the system for counting used by the ancient Sumerians, they introduced this sexagesimal system, where you had 1, 10, and then 60, 600, 3,600, and 36,000, a mixture of use of tens and sixties, which actually survives today in the way in which we divide hours into minutes and seconds and divide circles into degrees. And so rather interestingly, we still use this and other elements of ancient Babylonian counting in today's counting systems. Gone the wrong way. I will move forward slightly, I'll move forward quite a long way, to what is probably recognised as the first mathematical biology research paper to be published within what we might call modern science, post-Enlightenment. And this is a work by the Swiss mathematician Daniel Bernoulli, and he published a work in 1766 looking at the analysis of mortality caused by smallpox. Now, his interest, again, was in a human epidemic here, although I will link this in subsequent slides to farm animal epidemics. His interest was in human epidemics, and particularly with regards to the calculation of annuities for life tables based on what might be the case were one to be able to eliminate smallpox, the smallpox vaccine having been introduced. There is a very good modern reworking of this by Klaus Dietz in the paper that I've listed there in terms of modern epidemiological theory, and I will use their reworking of his work because it expresses it in modern terms. So now I'm putting up equations. This is there for just to show you what the language of mathematics looks like. So people who are not familiar with what those equations mean, don't worry too much. There's no real technical exercises associated with this talk. But this is the very basis of Daniel Bernoulli's model. And the way in which the model works goes something like this. We divide the population into two groups of people. There are people who might be susceptible to catching the disease, and then there are people who are immune from the disease. They've had the disease and are now immune from it. And various things happen with these people, and these are things that, you know, make kind of sense. They can become infected, they could then die from that infection, or they can survive and become immune. Or people might die from other causes not related to smallpox. And indeed, both the susceptible and the immune individuals may die from other causes. Of course, the interesting thing is that one would make the assumption that the people who are susceptible and die from other causes and the people who are immune and die from other causes, that's the same. That's dying from other causes. And there's the additional deaths as a result of smallpox that is the difference between those two groups and their rates in which they die. Now, there are many ways in which one does mathematical modelling in biology. The most frequently used way are these things called differential equations. And basically, these are one way in which you can describe the processes of the biology. In this case, it's becoming infected, dying from the infection, or surviving the infection and becoming immune from that infection. And the ways in which you can describe those processes in mathematical language, which allows you then to put numbers onto those groups of individuals, rates at which these different biological processes happen, and therefore make predictions as to what might happen should you change something, say, for example, eliminate smallpox. And you can do this mathematically, and the language of mathematics allows you a set of tools to carry out those sorts of calculations. So you can say, if I change this particular element of the biology, what's going to happen? Can I calculate it? And that's what the mathematics allows you to do and is very powerful in that regard. So here is a graph showing some of the predicted results, and the black line on this graph shows the mortality by age associated with the population at that time. And you can see there that basically what you've got is a kind of a cumulative distribution. If you started at 1, that means 100% of people are alive when they're born. And then as you go down that black line, that's the percentage of people who are alive at a particular age. So you can see the black line in that population. By the time you're 11.5, 50% of people had actually died. And of course, in not very long ago, it was the case that 50% of people died as children. And that's something that we're very fortunate to be living in today's world, where that is not the case. And you can see, say, for example, by age 60, only 20% of people in those days survived to be 60 years old. So it's very different from mortality today. The dashed line has been calculated using Daniel Bernoulli's model. And it assumes a smallpox fatality rate of 12.5%, which was estimated indeed by Bernoulli using figures at the time. And you get a dashed line for the kind of mortality of people as a result of a sort of a imagined elimination of smallpox. And you can see that the 50% point is shifted quite a long way. It's actually shifted from 11.5 years to 25.5 years. So by eliminating smallpox, the prediction is that you'd actually have a major impact on surviving childhood for people at that time. So it would be clear from this kind of exercise that it would be an extremely worthwhile activity to attempt to do. Now, I've talked about human epidemics. Here in Sutton Bonington, we are generally interested in agricultural research. And, of course, farm animal epidemics generally reach public consciousness at a very high level, and they kind of reach the news and have a major impact on our society. We probably, many of us will remember most of these epidemics of various forms. We remember the BSE epidemic of 1996. That was a pretty big deal. The foot and mouth disease epidemic of 2001, and the images of the burning cattle and sheep, bird flu, which of course is affecting humans, and swine flu, which was also important in humans, but these were also associated with farm animals. And these epidemics come up very regularly and make the news whenever they do come up, and always have large-scale public impact. The foot and mouth disease virus, I will talk very briefly about that, because that is an example where some of the people who worked in mathematical modelling of the epidemic actually had a major impact on government policy and, through it, on the livelihoods and lives of farmers. It is a what we call an RNA virus, and that's the way in which its genes are encoded. It's slightly different from our human genes, and that molecule called DNA. It's very rapidly transmitted between farm animals, including cattle and sheep and pigs. And the important point is that in the epidemic 10 years ago, 10 million animals were culled to an estimated cost of £8 billion. This was a huge, huge impact economically, socially, and indeed on the people involved. Now, that culling policy came as a result of a particular group of mathematical modellers and their work. Some people here might know some of these characters. And this is a quote from their research paper on the subject at the time, and it says, "The model is used to make predictions of future incidents and to simulate the impact of additional control strategies. Culling is predicted to be more effective than vaccination." And indeed, this is the work that led to the government policy, for better or worse. Now, I might say modern epidemic models actually look extremely similar to the epidemic models that were used by Daniel Bernoulli. They're enormously similar. So here is a very simple example of such a model. It has an additional compartment because it actually considers not just the susceptible individuals, but also the individuals who are infected. And in a modern epidemic model, you will typically have birth of individuals into the susceptible pool. You'll have death of both the susceptible and the infected individuals. But you'll also have this kind of interesting feedback by which infected individuals may indeed infect other susceptible individuals. And this feedback makes this model what we call non-linear, which means that it has some interesting behaviours and can, for example, display epidemics and so forth as a result of this kind of positive feedback within the system. A model that would be used for serious purposes, such as calculating government policy, would typically include all sorts of other complicated factors that would be built into this, such as age of the animals, disease progression, a spatial structure. You may divide the country up into regions or into individual farms and look at the... And look at the way in which infections may actually... be travelling from one neighbouring area to another, which may be very different because obviously you wouldn't expect an animal in Leicestershire to suddenly infect an animal in Scotland, and so forth. Again, one would write down this system in mathematical language. This is a slide from some teaching I have done at undergraduate and also postgraduate level, where I ask students to simulate this simple epidemic model and to simulate a kind of a version of a vaccination and culling strategy embedded in the model. And one can do this by changing certain parameters, by saying, okay, if we vaccinate animals, that means that there would be... fewer infection rate and so forth. And as you can see, or maybe you can see, this simulation of this very simplified version of the model shows a red line showing the epidemic, and you can see it starts from zero and it goes to some kind of peak and then dies off again. And then the dotted line shows the epidemic were we to put culling in, and you can see it's a much lower peak, whereas the dashed line shows the epidemic in the case of vaccination, and we see a later peak and slightly lower, but a lot more animals involved in the epidemic than should we carry out a culling strategy. Now, that's not to talk about the rights and wrongs of what happened 10 years ago, it's simply to say that these models can be used to make these sorts of predictions, and obviously government policy should be informed by many things, not just this sort of exercise. So there's an example of kind of, I said, counting sheep, the use of numbers in mathematics, in biology. I'll talk briefly now in a slightly different track about computers. Now, computers, of course, are ubiquitous in everyday life, and they're an extremely important part of what we do in mathematical modelling in biology. The computer, of course, was invented by the great Victorian mathematician and thinker Charles Babbage, although he was never successful in building one. Actually, the reason why he was never successful in building one is because although he got a preliminary grant from the British government, he was unable to get follow-up funding because he actually was, in modern parlance, unable to demonstrate sufficient economic impact of his work on the computer. And the kind of scientific referee, George Airy, who was the president of the Royal Society, just sort of said to the government he didn't believe there would be sufficient economic impact to make this worthwhile. It's an interesting case study in trying to obtain research funding. This is actually the mill, the calculating bit of his analytical engine, which was actually built by his son Henry, and sits in the Science Museum, to the best of my knowledge. But interestingly, it was kind of recognized that there might be biological applications to computers right from the word go. There was one person in the country who did actually understand the importance of Charles Babbage's invention, and that was Ada Lovelace. And she was the daughter of Lord Byron, the poet, and she was, a mathematician in her own right, although she only published one paper, as it was very difficult for women in those days. In fact, her husband had to join the Royal Society in his own name to use the library to be able to borrow things that really she wanted, because she wasn't allowed to enter the Royal Society in those days as she was a woman. And she wrote a commentary on Babbage's invention. It was a translation of an Italian text describing it, and she wrote a commentary about its potential uses. And she wrote a number of interesting and very insightful matters. A couple of quotes here, one of which says, "The analytical engine might act upon other things beside number, were objects found whose mutual fundamental relations could be expressed by those of the abstract science of operations, and which also should be susceptible of adaptations to the operating notation and mechanism of the engine. So she recognised that this was a very abstract device that could be used in a wide range of fields, and actually, following this section, she actually goes on to talk about the fact that this could have use in music as a way of manipulating musical compositions. And then a little later in the commentary, she writes, "The analytical engine weaves algebraical patterns just as the Jacquard loom weaves flowers and leaves." And this is, I think, the first biological reference in relation to computing. The Jacquard loom was, of course, the automated weaving loom invented by Jacquard, of course. And this is the device that used punched cards for the patterns. And it was from that punched card loom that Babbage had the idea of using punched cards as inputs into the computer, and of course that then took off into the computing world. But punch cards did actually have their origin in weaving. But when one talks about modern computers, one talks about electronic computers, and of course one of the leading lights of the electronic computer, living 100 years or so after Babbage, was Alan Turing. Alan Turing is famous for a number of reasons, partly because he actually defined what it was that a computer does, what makes a computer, and partly because of his involvement in very early computers, particularly during World War II and the code-breaking efforts that were going on in Bletchley Park. And this is a computer that Turing was involved with. This is the Colossus that was used for decoding the Lorentz machine, the German, the more advanced German encryption machine. And it's a very large computer, and it has all sorts of switches and relays and other exciting things in it. But very interesting is that Alan Turing, who was so influential in the early development of the digital computer, also wrote about biology. And he wrote a seminal paper in 1953 called The Chemical Basis of Morphogenesis. And he writes in this, "The purpose of this paper is to discuss a possible mechanism by which the genes of a zygote may determine the anatomical structure of the resulting organism." And indeed, it is this work that actually is the foundation stone of the use of mathematics in developmental biology, in the way in which organisms grow, and that is also something that takes place here in Sutton Bonington, as we will see. I'll talk very briefly about what it is that he did. He was interested in the formation of biological patterns, limbs and organisms, or coat patterns on zebras or other kind of animals. And the model that he introduced was an idea that said we might have two chemicals. Of course, in those days these were not known or identified or in any way pinned down to any specific molecules. And one might have one morphogen that activates itself and activates another morphogen, but a second morphogen that represses itself, it shuts itself down and shuts down the other one. And so you've got one thing that's tending to switch things on and one thing that's tending to switch things off. And these will obviously be in competition with each other in some way. But these are not just in one kind of one pot, but they're actually moving. They're actually what we call diffusing. And for those who are perhaps less familiar with diffusion, just imagine you drop a little bit of ink or food colouring in a glass of water. You'd see the colour just kind of spreading out gradually. And that's what these morphogens are doing. They would be spreading out. The molecules would go from an area of high concentration into areas of low concentration, like an ink drop would spread in a glass of water. And if they happen to be reacting with each other in this way and also diffusing in a certain way, one can write down mathematical equations that describe these processes. And these are other equations called reaction-diffusion equations that describe how these kinds of molecules might interact with each other but also move around in a tissue, for example. And there I mentioned zebra because I had a picture of a zebra coming along. And here are some simulations of this kind of model to simulate different coat patterns on that might appear on animals. And you can see that on the basis of this kind of morphogenesis, one can indeed get the sorts of stripes or spots that one does indeed see on animals. Now, of course, there are many applications of this kind of approaches, not just in things like animal patterns, but also in areas of research closer to home. As I'm sure many people here know, Sutton Bonington hosts one of the main systems biology centres that was funded by the research councils a few years ago. In the case of Nottingham, it is the Centre for Plant Integrative Biology, which is £9 million of funding from the BBSRC and the EPSRC. And a large part of this research is to produce what's called a virtual route, a computer simulation of a real route. The interests, of course, in producing virtual routes is indeed to help with crop development, particularly to be able to survive drought or salt stress, and to be able to do so in ways that will indeed improve availability and access to food globally. This is a major project. It involves enormous collaborations between a wide range of fields, including both experimental and theoretical work that link together. So work to actually make a large number of measurements and also work to produce models that can be used to make predictions. And so this kind of work in terms of development and pattern formation is something that goes on here and is very much inspired by that early work by Alan Turing associated with early computers. Now, what about modern computers? I'm on this computing theme. What about modern computers? Well, we use as big computers as we can get our hands on most of the time, and there's a reason for that. On the bottom right-hand corner, I have a picture of a part of the high-performance computing infrastructure here at the University of Nottingham. There's actually the nicest photograph I could find, but it's a photograph of it before the upgrade. And it now contains more than 2,000 compute nodes and is a very important resource to the university as a whole. Why do we need such big computers? Well, one reason is as follows. The big picture is a map of metabolism in the bacterium Escherichia coli. It's all the different chemicals that we know of that can be made and all the different enzymatic processes by which those chemicals can be transformed by chemical reactions from one to another by enzymes produced by the organism. And this is a relatively simple organism. It is quite large and complicated. The models I showed you so far had a small number of compartments. We had infected individuals and susceptible individuals, or we had two morphogens interacting. But of course, what's really going on, if you have a model of a plant root or a model of a metabolism of an individual, is you now have many hundreds or thousands of entities interacting with each other in very interesting and complicated ways that one cannot simply write down two equations and do a little bit of simulations on a personal computer. One actually needs large-scale computers to be able to carry out simulations and investigations on models that are going to be realistic to the sorts of knowledge we have in biology and the sorts of data we're now able to generate within experimental biology. And so we actually need very powerful computers today, and this is likely to continue into the future. And one of the reasons why it continues now is because the modern technologies for measuring biological entities, whether it's the new sequencing technologies or mass spectrometry or whatever it is, computing infrastructure is an integral part of the actual instrumentation. And so as the computers improve, so the instrumentation improves, and so the amount of data you get improves, and so you need bigger computers. And so the two are very closely coupled in modern biology. Well, that's a little bit of numbers and a little bit of computers. I hope that sets a kind of a scene for the sorts of ways in which we use mathematics and computing in biology. I just wanted to finish off by talking briefly about three of the projects that are going on in my lab, so people here can know what it is that I do and the people I work with do. We have a number of funded projects at the moment. All the work that we carry out is in close collaboration with experimental groups. So although I'm a mathematician myself and we work on mathematics and computers, we do so in collaboration with experimental biology. I will talk about three projects. The first is microbial gene regulation. We're very interested in microbial gene regulation. That is how genes get switched on and switched off in different environments. One particular interest we have is in pathogenic E. coli strains. And in this context, I'm sure you're all familiar with the recent outbreak in Germany of pathogenic E. coli that killed 40 people and infected many thousands of people. That was the largest outbreak. The second largest outbreak, which had previously been the largest outbreak, was actually in Osaka in Japan. And we have a collaboration with scientists from Osaka and nearby NARA Institute of Science and Technology, also in Japan, obviously, that's been funded by the BBSRC and the Japanese Science and Technology Council. And this is work with John Hobman here in Sutton Bonington and also a number of Japanese collaborators to look at pathogenic E. coli strains and also indeed healthy non-pathogenic E. coli strains to try to get a better understanding of how they respond to metals in the environment. Now, metals are very important for a number of reasons, partly because some metals can have an antimicrobial effect. So you may be familiar with now the increasing use of silver in things like chopping boards or socks or other items as a way of trying to eliminate microbes. The use of copper handles. Of course, hospitals used to have brass handles because copper itself is antimicrobial in sufficient quantities. We're also interested in metals like iron and zinc, which are essential in small quantities but lethal in larger quantities. And indeed, if a microbe like an E. coli microbe is going to establish a successful infection in your gut, it's going to need to get hold of iron and zinc in order to be able to do so and to cause an infection. We have been working on zinc regulation, and so we have been building mathematical models of systems like this, where one considers zinc in the environment that might go in and out of the cells through certain proteins that are there to either take the zinc up or to remove it from the cells, and various other genes that are involved in the kind of the control, the way in which the cell can sense whether or not it's got not enough zinc or too much zinc, and therefore appropriately switch on systems to either bring in more or pump out more zinc as appropriate. But we do this work in collaboration with experimental workers who generate data, and then we feed experimental data into these models as a way of trying to identify what might be important factors involved in these systems, and indeed where one might want to expend energies for further experimental work. Our largest research funding at the moment is a collaboration with Phil Hill and Dave Scott, also in food science, and we're interested here in glow-in-the-dark bacteria. Now, this is a technology that really is Phil's domain of expertise, and here is an example of some mice that have got some glow-in-the-dark bacteria on them. What we're interested here is in using glow-in-the-dark technologies as a way of seeing how bacteria might respond to things that we might do to them. Perhaps importantly, treating them with potential antibiotics. In this case, these are mice that have got a Staphylococcus aureus infection, as in the same bacterium that is familiar to you as MRSA, and they will stop glowing if they die. And this is obviously going to be an interesting and useful application of these technologies. What it allows you to do is to carry out experiments on far fewer animals than you might do if you wanted to, say, for example, infect a mouse with a disease like this, and you had to understand what it's doing by killing the mouse. Here we don't have to do that. We can keep the mice alive, we can image them over a period of time, and then we can actually identify how the bacteria are responding to whatever it is we're trying to do to them. Now, as it turns out, the glow-in-the-dark bacterial technology is not as simple as it might sound. It actually, there is a whole series of chemical reactions associated with the way in which that light is produced. And those chemical reactions depend on many different inputs and many different factors. And indeed, there is an interesting problem, which is, given a certain amount of light, what does that actually tell you about the thing that you're trying to measure? And that's not an easy problem. And in order to tackle that, again, I have got together with experimental collaborators. This is, again, Phil Hill and Dave Scott, and the two postdocs employed on this grant, Mudassik Bal and Neil Doherty. And what we're doing is we've built mathematical models for these biochemical processes, but we're also taking measurements of those processes so that we can understand how quickly they occur and to what extent they occur. And that way, when we get a measurement of the amount of light, we can actually work out, using these models and using these measurements, we can actually work out what's actually really going on, what is changing in the particular thing that we're trying to measure. And this is work in progress in another BBSRC-funded project. Finally, a newish venture within our lab. This is a collaboration with Catherine Smart and other collaborations also with John Hobman and Helen West and Theo Kypreos in statistics. And I can see Darren is here in the audience, who's also involved in some of this work, is looking at phenotypes of yeast in brewing and bioenergy applications, but also in pathogenic E. coli. And here what we're interested in doing is understanding how yeast or E. coli, but in this particular project, yeasts respond to a wide range of different environments. In the case of brewing, and we have a master's student working at the moment on this, they're interested in, this is work that's part funded by Sab Miller, and they're interested in the responses of yeasts that are used in beers that they make, beers that will be familiar to you, like Peroni or Grolsch, in terms of the fermentation processes associated with the production of those beers. There are technologies by which you can get interesting data about how those organisms are responding in different environments. And again, we are using mathematical models to extract important information from these data sets that can go on and say this particular change in the fermentation process will allow an improvement of whatever it is that you're trying to improve, higher production rate or whatever it is we're interested in. These are being applied both to brewing technologies and also hopefully to bioenergy production, again in which yeasts are being used to attempt to produce biofuels. So that really leads me to the end of my talk. The conclusions that I wished you to draw from this is, first of all, that mathematics in biology has an ancient and illustrious history. Mathematics and biology have actually always gone hand in hand throughout the development of both subjects, and will continue to do so, and I expect in much closer way over the next few decades. The computer technology plays a crucial role and always has done ever since its inception. Computers are part of what we do and a very important part of how we operate. That the applications have genuine impact in a wide range of different areas, including disease prevention, agriculture, and of course influencing government policy. And as I hope is also made clear, that there are very active research programs in all areas of activity that are happening here in Sutton Bonington, whether that's in animals, plants, microbes. This is going on here in many different research labs, and is a very important part of what we do. Thank you very much. Yeah, I mean that's a very interesting question. You're obviously referring to the instance of bovine tuberculosis and whether or not that is actually transmitted from badgers to cows, and indeed the use of culling of badgers as a way of controlling bovine tuberculosis. There is actually quite a lot of mathematical modelling in this area that is going on, and mathematical models are used in that field. The last time I spoke to anyone about it was about 10 years ago. And 10 years ago, I can tell you that the state of the mathematical modelling was that culling of badgers would have absolutely no impact whatsoever on controlling bovine TB. Now, whether or not that has changed as a result of modern data or modern modelling, I don't know. But of course, government policy isn't just influenced by mathematical models, but influenced by many factors, including farming lobby groups who want to see reduced incidence in bovine TB, and badger lobby groups who want to see reduced culling of badgers. And so of course, government has to make decisions on many different factors. I don't know the answer to that question. I don't know about vaccinations with bovine TB.
Can I ask a related question? With your microbe,
yeah.
It's a very detailed representation.
Yes.
It's very complicated.
Yes.
Well, one thing I was wondering, how much of it have you captured? It's very difficult to say. But with something very simple, you've got a very complicated representation. So to what extent can you say you've captured the microbe? What's missing in that simple example?
Even in a simple example, one would be leaving out more than one what has. And of course, there are a number of different philosophies towards mathematical modelling in terms of how much one puts in and how much one leaves out. In my view, a model is that. It's a model. It's not the real thing, and you don't want it to be the real thing, because if you wanted to study a model that was going to be as complicated as the real thing, then, well, why bother? You may as well just take the real thing and study it. And so a model... intrinsically, you need always to make some kind of simplifications, some kind of way of saying, we're interested in finding out what might be important and what might be less important, and so we're going to say, we're going to try looking at these bits or those bits. But of course, there is work that tries to put in as much as possible, and sometimes that is, of course, of great value as well. So with something like metabolism, if you've got something that's very complicated going on and you want to look at that, predict a response to a whole organism as a result of a particular change, sometimes you might need to put in as much information as you can to get an accurate prediction. Right. Well, actually, I hid a lot of the complexity, of course, because the reality is that in order to do a good foot and mouth disease model, you would want actually quite a detailed map of the UK in your model, and indeed such things would be used, which would actually include, you know, farm boundaries and things like this, so you could actually see how the infection might progress from one patch to another. So while I put up two equations, I was actually hiding what could actually be an incredibly complicated model as well. No, it's back, sorry.
I'm intrigued by that giant unicorn. I think there's such things as physical in the world today. So when you're doing things on that giant computer, does it take days and days to generate more data?
Yeah, well, that's also a very interesting question. I mean, there's more than one way of using giant computers, and it depends very much on the nature of the problem. For most of what we do with a giant computer, you'd typically be, for example, running the same model very many times in order to explore its behavior, in order to identify, you know, what parameters might be. And so you would be basically saying, I've got my particular model, and this giant computer, which in fact really consists of 2,000 little computers joined together, and we're going to say, right, I'm going to split this job up, and this bit of it is going to run the model 1,000 times, and this bit of it is going to run the model 1,000 times, and this bit of it is going to run the model 1,000 times. And so you're kind of very basically taking a job that on a single computer might take days and days, or weeks and weeks, and by splitting it up into smaller chunks that can be run on many different nodes of the giant computer, you can then run that in hours or minutes. And that's one way of using it. There are other applications, though, where you kind of need to use it as a giant computer. Examples might be things like climate change models. So people are working in environmental science. If you wanted to look at the impact of, say, a change in carbon emissions on the Earth's atmosphere, you would actually need to have a representation of Earth divided again also into spatial patches with information about continents and land and sea masses and vegetation and weather systems and so forth. And you'd actually need all those different bits to be able to talk to each other, because when the wind blows somewhere, then the wind's blown somewhere else, and so you need all the computers to talk to each other. And then the giant computer is indeed used as a giant computer, as a kind of a single entity, and you'll be using it in a different way, and you might have a simulation that might run for quite some period of time, because that's the only way you can do it.
So you have presented some past studies in which they use Did these models always make the correct predictions? Is there any kind of validating what the model predict, or how far?
Right. Well, I mean that's also a very important question, and it's actually something that has very much evolved over time. I mean, certainly it would be the case 20 or 30 years ago that people working in mathematical modelling in biology would sort of sit in math departments and they would do some nice mathematics, and people working in biology would kind of continue to do their experiments, and there was little contact between the two, and that's the way it was. The way things work now is actually quite differently, and what might be called the gold standard is seen as a kind of an iterative cycle between experimental and modelling work. The idea is that you might come up with a model, you might use experimental data to inform the model, you might come up with some predictions. That ideally these should actually lead to some concrete experiments that you could do and say and test those predictions, and then you do those experiments and then that refines your understanding of the system, and then you could build a better model and so forth. An example of that is I can give an example straight from the Centre for Plant Integrative Biology here at Sutton Bonington, where the model predicted that the gravitropism of roots, that is roots growing downwards, was a result of the dilution of a particular hormone, and indeed this was then experimentally borne out. And so there are many examples, and certainly in the modern world, most people, including myself, try to work in a very close coupled way with experimental scientists, and you try to make sure that the models. Well, the experiments are of value to the models, but also the models are of value to the experiments, so both ways work, if that makes sense. Well, thank you for the compliments, and thank you everyone for coming. I can't comment on quantity, but I'm sure the quality we have here is high. It's a very interesting and a very difficult question that I think impacts not just on university teaching but also on school teaching as well, because I think that a lot of the damage, as it were, has been done long before we get hold of the students. Of course, there are many of the students who are quite happy with numbers and perfectly happy to do so. I teach the mathematics element of the first year undergraduate program to all students here, and that encompasses a very wide range of students, from students who enjoy mathematics and find it interesting, and actually, to be honest, don't need to go to my lectures, to students who are frankly terrified of the whole thing and feel that they... And feel a real struggle with it. I think that it comes back to a school level issue, and I think that's a very difficult and interesting question, because you've got to find effective ways of teaching mathematics in school and effective ways of engaging young people with numbers, and that means, of course, recruiting excellent mathematics teachers. My mother-in-law runs the Gifted and Talented scheme at a difficult school in Neachels in North Birmingham, and she's done all sorts of exciting things with them with fractals in nature, and has had the young people she's working with going out and collecting ferns and producing and looking at the fractal nature of them and producing all sorts of fractals themselves, and they've become very excited by it. But not all teachers are able to be in a position to do that, and I think that's a very difficult and interesting question. And I haven't really answered you, but I don't think there's a quick answer I can give.
Show sort of things you can do, maybe that would capture people's imaginations and
I think I'm certainly going away feeling less scared of mathematics than when I came into the room. It's a real nightmare, and hope that everyone else feels the same way too. Just before we thank Doug, can I just say that the next session in the knowledge transfer talks is Arthritis, Why Is It Painful? And you can find all about that at 11:30 on the 15th of November, which is a Tuesday evening.